Thank you, Alvin. Good morning. I've spent days trying to figure out what I was going to talk about this morning. And when I made it a matter of prayer for the last time last night, you know what I was told? Janice will give it to you this morning in a song. And she did. You just sang it. Thank you. So now I know where to start, and I'm going to start in James. I'm going to start with the first chapter and the first verse. There's one thing that I'm slowly getting through my head. I haven't learned how to do it completely yet. But it's the notion that the gospel isn't just something you know, but it's something you do. And whenever you want to read, or whenever you want to study, or attend a study class, or whatever it is that you want to do about your religion, there's always got to be some things you think of first. What am I going to get out of it? Why am I looking at it the way I'm looking at it? The true gospel strengthens people so they can bear the burdens of life. And it also shows them the path in life that they should walk. That's pretty simple. If you take a look at the book of James, that's what it's about. The four Gospels are about the history of Christ and His teachings. The Bible itself is a history of God, what He's done, and how men have recorded it. James tells you how to behave. So I'm going to read a little bit in James this morning. And I'm going to start with chapter 1, verse 1. James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad, greeting. My brethren, count it all joy when ye fall into divers temptations, as various temptations, knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience. But let patience have her perfect work, that ye may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. The words that are written in the Scriptures are like the words that are used today. Same words, different meanings, depends on how you use them. If you take a look at the word perfect here, it's mature. It's ripened. It's usable. It's workable. And if you do it right, then you're workable and you have matured in the gospel. You're perfect. Another analogy would be you got a green apple, but when it ripens, it tastes a certain way, it can give you a stomach ache, but when it ripens, it's sweet. It's good for you. It's perfect. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, that giveth to all men liberally, and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. But then let him ask in faith, nothing wavering, for he that wavereth is like a wave of the sea, driven with the wind and tossed. For let not that man think that he shall receive anything of the Lord. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. Let the brother of low degree rejoice in that he is exalted, but the rich in that he is made low, because of the flower of the grass he shall pass away. For the sun is no sooner risen with a burning heat, but it withereth the grass, and the flower thereof falleth, and the grace of the fashion of it perisheth. So also shall the rich man fade away in his ways. And they're talking about your souls here. They're talking about your psychological makeup. They're talking about the way you look at things in life. And they're talking about the things that make you make the decisions you make, and therefore behave the way you behave. The attitude by which you look at things that affect you in your life, and then the decisions you make based on that attitude. That's what this is talking about. It's talking about the waves of the world that come and go, and they don't have any meat in them. There's no foundation, there's no basis, there's no strength. Then there's a way of the Lord that if we just look at them for what they mean and do them the way they're supposed to meant, it's strength to us, and it helps us look at things the way that we can handle them. And therein's the blessings. Blessed is the man that endureth temptation, for when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord hath promised to them that love him. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and when sin is finished, it bringeth forth death. Do not err, my beloved brethren. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, and cometh down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variableness, neither shadow of turning. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. He's not going to change his laws and his principles. Of his own will begat he us with the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. Wherefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. For the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God. I've asked this question before, I'll ask it to you again. Did you ever correctly fix a problem while you're mad? Did you ever correctly fix a problem when you're scared to death? You got to think about it, don't you? You can't make an emotional decision of any kind and come out right. But sadly enough, in our society today, we have an awful lot of emotional decisions that are made. Most of them are for instant gratification or for other selfish reasons. Because we want to be the smartest, we want to be the brightest, instead of what's good for everybody. Wherefore lay apart all filthiness and superfluity of naughtiness, and receive with meekness the engrafted word which is able to save your souls. But be ye doers of the word, and not hearers only, comma, deceiving your own selves. For if any man be a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is likened to a man beholding his natural face in a glass. For he beholdeth himself and goeth his way, and straightway forgetteth what manner of man he was. That brings me to my religion. And that should bring you to your religion. What do you do with your religion? What does your religion do to you? What does your religion do with you? Instead of what does your religion do for you? Is your religion a set of sayings? Is your religion one of status and position? Is your religion one of self-satisfaction? Is your religion politically motivated? Is your religion socially motivated? Or is your religion spiritually driven? See, you all have a spirit. I have a spirit, you have a spirit. You can't get rid of that spirit. When that spirit goes from you, you passed away. And it makes you think the way you think. And it makes you set the values that you set. And it makes you throw away some and embrace others based on what you want to do, what you feel comfortable with, what you enjoy. And the only problem with that is that, I don't know, there's probably 150 in here right now, something like that. So there's probably 150 answers to, or definitions to that. Do you ever try to put a complicated piece of machinery together with no instructions? Sometimes you ever put a bicycle together with no instructions? Depends on the complicated state of the machinery is how you're going to end up putting it together. Well, you've got some instructions for your life, and they're the same for you that they were for Adam. They're the same for you that they were for anybody from your lifetime on back and from your lifetime forward. And we all say we believe they work, but then do we really do them? The United States is supposed to be the most Christian nation in the world. You can take a look in about any one of the, especially the main cities in the United States when you drive through them, and you can look out across a landscape and look for church steeples, for one. Look at all the churches, and look at all the old fancy churches, and look at all the elegant churches. There's a lot of churches, and there's a lot of steeples. Of course, there's a lot of churches that don't have steeples. And they all tell you to love God. Some of them tell you they believe in Jesus Christ. But do they strengthen the people to bear their burdens in life? And do they teach people the difference between right and wrong? There's a lot of things that guide what you decide is a priority in your life. And there's a lot of different ways that other people can look at what you have picked for your priorities. And things can get pretty complicated when you go down through a process like that. One of the things that I'm always amazed at is how someone can stand here behind a desk and give you a phrase, and then when you listen to the hearers, plural, afterwards, how many different ideas you get of what he said. It's almost as many as people that read the Bible get when you can read a passage and then they'll tell you what they think it means, and it doesn't, to your way of thinking it or the way you're looking at it, it doesn't mean a thing to what it really says according to the way you look at it. That's not a new problem. That started off right with the beginning of civilization when Moses was given the law. And it went clear up to the time of Jesus Christ. Everybody had their own idea of what that meant, and everybody had their idea of what this meant. And what they did, they attached the scriptures to through their social way of looking at it, their political way of looking at it, their personal way of looking at it, and then they adapted and they adopted. And they didn't get it. There's a passage that I've read a lot of times, and I'm going to read it again. And it's one of the first, and one of the most, to me anyway, it's one of the most graphic ways of how people get things wrong. And it's in Deuteronomy. This is what the Jewish religion did with the scriptures that to me are pretty plain. And it's in the 6th chapter of Deuteronomy if you want to follow along. You probably, most of you know it by heart. Deuteronomy 6, and I'm going to start with the 4th verse. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might. See, that's the first commandment. That's when Jesus was tempted by the Pharisees, that was the first thing he told them. The other one's in Leviticus 19, chapter 18, verse, I love the neighbor as thyself. So he wasn't coming up with anything new. He was just reciting what had already been written. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. Don't forget that verse. That's a key verse. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thine hand, and there shall be as frontlets between thine eyes. And thou shalt write them upon the posts of thy house and on thy gates. I don't know about you, but what that means to me is that you've got to keep the gospel as is given to us by Jesus Christ to be the foremost, most controlling thing in your thoughts and in your awareness all the time. And if you do that, it'll show in your actions. It'll come out in your hands. And it's supposed to be the controlling factor in your house. It's supposed to be the overwhelming influence throughout your entire life. In every situation you meet, and everything you do, and everything you come up against, you go back and you check the scriptures to see if that's what you're supposed to be doing, or if you're not supposed to be doing it. Sadly enough, the Jews took that passage, among others, and wrote it on a piece of paper, put it in a box, and tied it on their head. Called a phylactery. I got on the internet this week, typed in the word phylactery, and I got a web page that was 6 pages long that tells you how to tie a phylactery on your head and on your hands. Now, I know some of you heard me say this a few times before, but that's their religion. Doesn't have anything to do with their heart. Completely, totally forgot verse number 6. Totally forgot verse number 6. Wrote it down on a piece of paper and ignored it. That's what's wrong with it. It didn't go to their hearts. They tie it on their heads so they can be religious, and that's it. Then they can go think and do and say whatever they want to do and think and say, because they're religious. Every Orthodox Jew today does that, and he does that honestly, he does that faithfully, he does that according to his way of being truthful, because that's what he's been taught and that's what he believes. That's the sadness of it. That's the tragedy of it. Instead of putting it in your heart, instead of making it a part of your soul, that's what drives you. It's your soul that drives you. It's your soul that makes you do all of the things that you do. And it tells you in the Book of Mormon that you're a natural enemy to God, and it's because of what you want to do instead of what God wants you to do. Why was Jesus tempted to show us how to stay away from those things. And what is it that he says each time when he was tempted? I think we covered that in Sunday school class this morning. It is written. Well, what does that mean to you when he says it is written? That means you get in your Bible and then you get in your Book of Mormon and you find out how to handle your problems and how to bear up under the burdens that life hands you, because the whole world gets the same problem that you get. Too many times today, in this day and age, religion is a ceremony. Religion is financial. Two incidents come to mind on the financial aspects of it. I was down in Tennessee in October. Got to talking to the guy next to us in one of the campgrounds we were in, and he was from Cincinnati, Ohio. Went to a big church there, and I won't tell you the name of it. Told him why I was down there, and he said, "Well," he says, "you know, my dad was a preacher, and I had two uncles that were preachers." And then his next words were, "And you know, when they preached and when they performed services and somebody tried to pay them, they wouldn't take it. They were almost offended if somebody tried to give them money for their services." He said, "But sadly enough, I got a son and a couple of nephews that won't take a pastor's position unless they're paid $100,000 a year." How sad. How sad that you can take something that is so precious to your life, that is so all-controlling if you'll let it, and you won't do it unless it's for money. One of our missionaries coming back from the Philippines was on a plane, found out he was studying beside a missionary of another denomination. I heard this down in a sermon in Phoenix. And they got to compare notes when they found out that they were both missionaries, and our missionary says, "Well, I've been over here about 6 times, I think it was, or 8 times. The other guy says, "Well, I've been over here 55 times. I thought, "Wow, you know, that's something to be coming over here and doing what we do 55 times. The other missionary says, "Well, where do you go?" And our missionary says, "Well, we go to Mindanao." He said, "Well, why do you go to Mindanao? That's dangerous." He said, "Well, that's where the Lord told us to go." He says, "Well, who do you see on Mindanao?" He said, "Well, we see the natives and indigenous people." He said, "Well, why would you go there? They don't have any money." You know, that's the same reason, one of the driving force that drove Martin Luther from the Catholic Church back when he did what he did. Back then, the word "works" had a different meaning than what we have and intend for it today, or understand it to be today. Because works back then were things you did to be religious in that church. And when they adopted the practice of selling indulgences, that was a straw that broke the camel's back for Martin Luther. You see, selling an indulgence, you bought an administration. We had two administrations here this morning. What would you think about each one of them being $35 apiece? It's inconceivable to us. It is inconceivable to us that we should make what has to do with the welfare of our souls financial. But that's what the world does with religion. A lot of them read the same book, the King James Version of the Bible that we read, and they get this out of it. The Jews had the verbatim thing that I just read in Deuteronomy, and they took one verse and they created a ceremony that covers 6 pages to do it so they can be religious. going to have to look it up again because I closed the book. Hymn number 308. You tell me what this has to do with ceremony, and you tell me what this has to do with finances, and you tell me what this has to do with power and position and recognition, which means ego. Jesus calls us o'er the tumult of our life's wild, restless sea. Well, when I saw those words, I couldn't even sing them this morning. It hit me so hard. Because that's exactly what he does. And if you don't think you're in a tumult, and this isn't a tumultuous world, you haven't been listening and reading and watching lately. Day by day his sweet voice soundeth, saying, Christian, follow me. Too many times in today's day and age, we don't even know what that word means, Christian. People could say they call themselves Christians, and they don't believe in a virgin birth. They don't believe that Jesus was divine. They don't believe in a resurrection. And that a lot of his sayings were just nice, warm, fuzzy things that we were saying to make you feel good. That's not a Christian. That's not a Christian at all. This entire Bible and this entire Book of Mormon is geared to Christian follow Jesus Christ as he taught the word of his Father in heaven. That's what it's about. And you can't take page 46 and page 1123 and just do them. You've got to do it all. First sermon that's recorded that Jesus Christ preached in the Mideast was the Sermon on the Mount. First sermon that Jesus Christ preached to the people in Central America was the Sermon on the Mount. Well, why wouldn't he come over here and teach the same thing? Why would he come over here and teach something different? If you take a look at the two, there's quite a bit of difference because the way that those two different societies talk, there's a lot of difference. It's a little plainer. In fact, it's quite a bit plainer in the Book of Mormon because it doesn't go through all of the Jewish and Greek idioms and sayings and phraseology that they used over in the Mideast. So it's easier to understand. It doesn't say, tear out your eye and cut off your hand if you're sinning. It says, get those things out of your heart. That's the way they talked back then over in the Mideast. If your eye offends you, pluck it out. It doesn't mean to literally tear it out. It means quit doing a thing. If you wanted to do it literally, they'd have to tear their mind out because their mind is what controls their hands and their eyes. And that's impossible. Jesus calls us from the worship of the vain world's golden store. Boy, there's nowhere in the world that that's more true in this day and age than in this United States of America. We're the richest, most powerful nation in the world as far as material wealth, military power, financial stability, you name it. And we're killing ourselves with it. We are spiritually killing ourselves with it. All of these blessings from God have made us a 30-minute society. We got to do it now, and I want it now, and I want to get it over with, and I want this instant gratification. Because if you really look at it, the technology, not the way it's used, but the technology we have today are all blessings. But we, being the carnal man, have to filthy it. We have to make it smutty. We have to abuse it. That's not God's fault that that's that way. That's our fault. Because we don't do the things that are in these books. And we don't think the way these books tell us to think. Back to James. I'm going to start with verse 23 since I forgot where I left off. For if any be a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like unto a man beholding his natural face in a glass. For he beholdeth himself and goeth his way, and straightway forgetteth what manner of man he was. That's how fickle we are. But whoso looketh into the perfect law of liberty and continueth therein, he being not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this man shall be blessed in his deed. If any man among you seem to be religious and bridleth not his tongue, but deceiveth his own heart, this man's religion is vain. Now, how many of you are going to agree with this next verse? Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this: to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction and keep himself unspotted from the world. See, that's only got about two lines in my Bible, three lines, the way my Bible's laid out. But there's a whole lot said there in that, on what pure religion and undefiled is. There's a whole lot of things that you and I have to adjust, change, amend, and put into our lives to be able to even recognize what that means. If you take a look at the Beatitudes, if you take a look at the Beatitudes, I just read you part of the Beatitudes. If you take a look at the Sermon on the Mount, James is just another way of saying it. You go to Galatians where it tells you about the lust of the flesh and the fruit of the Spirit, says the same thing, just got different words. There's a passage in Messiah. I'll have to go to it. On page 220. In fact, I think I'll close with that. I'm going to read you a different set of words, but it basically says the same thing. Chapter 2, page 220 in the book of Messiah. And I've read and read and read this, and I'll read and read and read it again. Start with verse 13. Believe in God. See, that's just not something you say. That's something you do. And you do it with all of the things that I just talked about. Believe that He is. And that He created all things, both in heaven and in earth. And we forget that. Boy, do we ever forget that. Believe that He hath all wisdom and all power, both in heaven and in earth. And that's something we always forget. We forget that a lot. That He's the one that knows it all, not me. I don't stand up here and give you all these new bright ideas. All I'm hoping I'm getting you to do is think about yourself. Think about where you are and what you're doing. And where are you? And where do you want to go? And how are you going to get there? Scientists have the erroneous idea that they can look back to the beginning of time with them. I'm not sure I believe that. But what that shows me is what God created. And it literally is tens of thousands of light years beyond my life right here. As a matter of fact, if you take a look at just our galaxy, we're just one little speck in billions of stars. God created all that. But He listens to your prayers individually. Now you take someone that can do all the things in this, not just His universe, in existence that He's created and set in place, and all the laws of geology and physics and chemistry that He's set in place But yet he will still hear every one of your prayers individually. Can you honestly comprehend that? I want to believe it. I believe it. I really honestly believe it. I can't tell you how it is. I can't describe to you. Except it's wonderful. He's the same one who wrote these books for you and me on how we're to behave. He's the same one that gave us the hope that the world doesn't give you. By what's written in these books, if you just read it that way. We can't comprehend God. We try. We should never stop trying. But we have to remember our place. That he's the one that knows it all. And again, believe that you must repent of your sins and forsake them. That's two things. You've got to change the way you think about sin, and then you have to not do it. Humble yourselves before God. It's our job for us. Lord, I'm wrong. One of the things that I've come to understand is that in the Bible, there is nothing in the Bible that's contradictory. If it contradicts, then I'm reading it wrong. And there's nothing in the Book of Mormon that's contradictory. And if I'm finding a contradiction, then I'm reading it wrong. And the Bible and the Book of Mormon have no contradictions between themselves. And if there is, I'm the one that's doing it. And I'll tell you why that's important. I have run into several instances, and this may not work for you, but boy, it works for me, where someone has read me a passage and says, that can't be true. And the way they read it to me sounds true. And they said, but that's not true. That can't be. That's got to be written wrong. And all I got to remember is there are no contradictions. And if there's a contradiction, I'm making it. And you know what that makes my mind do? It makes it turn around. Instead of saying it's wrong, it's right. And if you go back and read before and after, 999 times out of 1,000, you'll see where there is no contradiction. It is right. You were just looking at it wrong. So it's up here. It's right back to what's up here. Another example, and I've had issues on me quite a bit. When Judas Iscariot died, one gospel says that he hung himself. The other one says that he fell and his bowels burst. They're both right. Because if you go back and you look at what the practice was in those days when someone would hang themselves, they were left. The body was left there until it rotted and the head came off and they would fall and they would bust open. Kind of gory. But that's not a contradiction, you see. It's just one said part of it and another said another part. So when you humble yourselves before God, a lot of times you get to humble yourself when you're just reading the scriptures, just to get out of them what is really meant instead of what you want to make it. And humble yourselves before God and ask in sincerity of heart that he would forgive you. And then it says, now if you believe all of these things, see that you do them. So you can't memorize that passage. You can't memorize any passage in the Bible or the Book of Mormon and be correct. You can't give $10 million for this church and be religious. You can't stand up here and absolutely, totally impress, awe, and wow everybody out there and be right by your words. You've got to do it. And you've got to do it from the minute you wake up in the morning till the minute you go to sleep at night. It's got to be in your mind. It's got to be the foremost thing in your mind. It's got to be to a functional understanding in your mind on how to do it, how to recognize it. And I will absolutely guarantee you No matter what the situation is, if you do it that way, it'll work. All you got to do is do it. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Brother Roger.
Let us turn to hymn number 190 for our closing hymn this morning. I would remind you to pick up your bulletins and especially the January calendars from out there in the foyer. Be sure you get them home and hang on to them so that you'll know what's going on and when it's going on. And following the singing of 190, I'll ask Brother Denham if he'll come back up here and dismiss us in prayer.